I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Merle Lefkoff. She's an international mediator. She's founder and the president of the Center for Emergent Diplomacy. She's a former guest scientist at the Center for Nonlinear Studies at Los Alamos. And we're here to talk about something called Bretton Woods 3.0. It's a conference coming up in the somewhat distant future. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be back.
It's great to have you back. We've had you on the radio before talking about the national and international happiness initiatives. Now, the conference Bretton Woods 3.0, it's based on a conference that actually did happen at the end of World War II called Bretton Woods, which happened in the woods of New Hampshire. What was that?
Right. There's a gorgeous retreat center up in the woods of New Hampshire called, and the name of it is Bretton Woods. It still exists, by the way. It's owned by a huge multinational corporation now. But in 1944, before the end of World War II, Europe was on its knees, Japan was destroyed. The Allied powers came together and negotiated for over a month about how to reconstitute a global economy that was in shatters because of World War II. And that happened at Bretton Woods. And then even today, 70 years later, it's known as the Bretton Woods system.
And that was 1944.
That was 1944. Even before the end of the war, the Allied powers were very smart about getting together to think about what to do next when the war was over.
So they got together and basically said, here's what our world economy is going to look like?
They basically got together and said, here are some potential scenarios for a world economy that will help Europe recover. I mean, basically, they were focused on Europe. And the U.S., of course, was the commanding power also at Bretton Woods at that conference. There were 730 delegates, by the way, Mary Charlotte. They were all men. If you look at the pictures, archival pictures from that age, it wasn't a very diverse crowd.
Right.
But they got together. They were some of the best economists in the world, including John Maynard Keynes, by the way, who represented Great Britain. And they debated and they negotiated. And basically what they came up with were some new structures for a new global economy. And that included, most centrally, the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and the World Bank.
Right. And so Bretton Woods, 1944, the International Monetary Fund, the group that became the World Bank, and a whole monetary system came from that. And I think it's really important to talk about the fact that no matter how much we think that there are free markets, that any economic system that we live in is based on a set of rules and standards that have come into being by groups of people who said this is how the system works.
I mean, the intent was a system that would help the whole world recover in a balanced way. That truly was the intent of the system. Unfortunately, John Maynard Keynes, who had a really brilliant idea about how to do that, was pretty much shot down by the American delegation.
What was his brilliant
idea? I'm not an economist, so I'm cautious about even talking about this. But from what I've read about this, John Maynard Keynes had the idea for a central bank that would be sure that when the countries in the world who had more than they needed, who became rich because of geography, because of population, because of entrepreneurship, would at some point in the central bank be required to share some of that excess capital with those countries in the world that were still recovering or that still or weren't up to par. And that was shot down. And so we had a different kind of system that was structured.
So fast forward 70 plus years since then, and what we have is, on the one hand, a highly developed world economy, on the other hand, incredible environmental destruction that threatens humanity itself, crushing poverty, and a whole host of other problems that are the direct result of this economy. We've got sort of the best and the worst.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so one of the things that's happening in the world is people beginning to think about how to transform Bretton Woods, how to transform that into something that will work for the 21st century. And a lot of new and important texts are coming out. Academics are working on this. We have new computer models that finally connect global climate change to the present failures of the global economy, because that's very recent that that's been done.
So Bretton Woods 3.0 is conceived of as your kind of brainchild as a new conference to get together all kinds of people and maybe a whole different ilk of people than those who were at the first Bretton Woods conference to talk about what? How to make a new world economy that does work?
You know, I'm interested. This is what's so different. There are many conferences that are talking about this and bringing together the best, what we now call thought leaders in the world, people who are academics, people who write, people who are philosophers, people who are journalists. Some fabulous journalism is coming out about this as well. I'm frankly interested in those people at the very grassroots level where social change is catalyzed, because they take ideas to action. So this conference is very, very different. One of the ways it's different is we are not anticipating that this conference will involve any speeches, perhaps an opening talk, and that's it. This is a working conference. It will be small working groups that will be talking about how do you take these ideas that are all over the world now for how to transform the Bretton Woods system into something that will work in the 21st century, how to transform that into social action. What are the best strategies for that? What are the best tactics? Do we go to the streets? Do we do boycotts? We can go through a whole litany of what social action and direct action means.
So what are some of those ideas that already exist that are on the ground in a small, kind of more small-scale or grassroots way that you would like to see in a bigger kind of world economic system?
Well, you know, it's happening right here in Santa Fe last week with what's going on with PNM and what PNM is doing in terms of affecting our local community with their coal-fired plants, their plans for coming back on some of the, you know, letting go of some of those coal-fired plants, but not embracing more local renewable technology. And there's a huge, if you've been down to the Capitol, if you've been to the PRC meetings, you know people are not only demonstrating in the streets every day, but packing these meetings. Those are wonderful tactics for letting everybody in this community know that we have to do something to lead to more renewables, which leads to helping to slow down global climate change. So there's always a connection to the global, but it begins at the local level, and it's happening right here in Santa Fe, and that's just one example of what's happening last week. Another example is the public banking movement here in Santa Fe, and that is another small social movement that's going in a completely different direction strategically, which is how do we get state legislation to set up what would be the second public bank in America? There's only one other. So those are just two examples very locally of different strategies for making social change.
And the bottom line for both of those is, for the first one, having more renewable energy and having a municipal utility, and in the second one, having municipal banking.
Yes. Well, there are many people who think we really need to own our own local grid.
Right.
So that's part of the mix too. But right now it's mostly about renewables.
So we're talking to Merle Lefkoff about Bretton Woods 3.0. Now the first one was 1.0. Did a 2.0 happen?
The reason I call it 3.0 is because when we went off the gold standard in the 70s when Nixon was president, and we had to float currencies all over the world, that really changed the Bretton Woods system to a very large extent.
And some people, because the original one was based on the gold standard.
Based on the gold standard. So that's why I'm calling it Bretton Woods 3.0.
Very interesting. So a lot of what you're talking about is challenging capitalism, which it's such an interesting moment that we're living in, because, I mean, in the United States, the media, I think, have kind of conflated capitalism, democracy, freedom, and everything else that's good. And when you look at the dark side of capitalism, even as it provides us the many comforts that we take for granted, and I have to say, I mean, I really enjoy a kind of basic middle-class lifestyle, which is utterly and completely a product of capitalism. It is a very comfortable way to live and a very productive way to live, you know, gives you a baseline for that. But when you look at the dark side, it's really ugly.
I'm so glad you think you're a member of the middle class, because as we know, one of the things that is happening is the disappearance of the middle class with this dark side of capitalism.
Exactly.
More and more of the people we both know, Mary Charlotte, have slipped from the middle class into the working class, particularly since the last Great Recession, it's being called, in 2008.
And the difference between those two terms, middle class and working class, basically, in a lot of ways, working class is defined by not being able to make ends meet.
That's right. It means accumulating debt.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah.
So that we become a more and more unequal society and a more debt-ridden society. So that's just part of the dark side. I think the real dark side, and you brought it up at the very beginning, is the effect on our ability to sustain our planetary natural systems. That's the big dark side of what's being called everything from rampant capitalism to out-of-control capitalism. So how do we slow down global climate change, whether we're at the tipping point or not at the tipping point? People will be debating that for a very long time.
Until it's totally tipped over.
Until it's totally tipped over. Some things have tipped over. Other things haven't. Other things are getting there. But it is a crisis, and it's a crisis that is increasingly in our faces, and so we're going to see more and more social action and direct action about global climate change. I went to New York for the Global Climate Change People's March. They were expecting, hoping for 100,000, and got close to a 500,000, over 400,000. It was a remarkable march. It was about global climate change, and I saw over and over again as I was marching many, many placards and banners that talked about the global economy causing this destruction of our natural resources.
So it's one thing to get out in the street, and getting out in the street is very empowering for the people who do it. It's also increasingly, over the years, ignored or trivialized by most of the media in the world. Particularly in this country, what do you see as the effects of things like the People's Climate March?
The People's Climate March looks like it's been very successful at this point because, as you know, the idea that started it, which was a small and kind of local, it was local, was the Keystone XL pipeline. And President Obama, at the highest levels of policy, has held off on making a decision on that. And it looks like it's going to die, not only because the decision was held off, but because the economy is a dynamical, complex system. It's changing all the time, and the price of oil, a barrel of oil, has gone way down. And it may not be financially feasible to even build that pipeline now.
Yeah, but it'll go back up.
Well, it will. It goes up and down. But the point is they've been very successful in holding off that decision. And it remains to be seen whether this is a permanent success or not. But the reason that was, I think, as successful as it was the numbers. And one of the things about Bretton Woods, and this is something that I don't know of any other conference who would want to do working groups around this issue, is can you mobilize in a mass way and keep it nonviolent? That's absolutely a principle of this. Keep it nonviolent. And mass in such a way that you can really truly have a global mass social movement that involves many kinds of direct action so that, as you said, the press and the media can no longer ignore it.
So one of the things that I think is an interesting distinction is when people get out there, and this is something that you so often see in leftist politics is the word no. No this, no that, stop this, stop sure. that. And good reasons for it, because when you have a world that is being poisoned or warmed or acidified into dangerous places, you want to put a stop to that. But then there's the question of what to do instead. And what to do instead is not necessarily a protest movement, but it's a set of systems. I mean, for example, one of the things that we talk about when we talk about economics is what are called externalities. And so if PNM has a coal plant, they will reap the profit on selling the energy, but they won't pay for the losses, namely the asthma, the health costs of the people who get sick,
right.
whether it be asthma or other respiratory infections, from their coal plant. Those are called externalities. And I've often wondered, and I don't know how much work there is on that, of what kind of regulations could be put in place, and if they've been put in place, to internalize the costs of any company's business.
This is, there's two things I want to respond to that you said. One of the, one of our primary goals at the Bretton Woods Conference is to see if it's possible to reframe global direct action toward positive messages as opposed to negative messages. We think it can be done, and we have this idea, although I can't prove this, that in the long run will be more successful. That you are out on the streets for something that you're passionate about, that you're also compassionate about, as opposed to stopping something or being against something.
Right.
So that's also one of our goals, is to explore that. And you mentioned that the happiness movement is about measuring the economy differently so that the externalities are taken into consideration. For example, the way we measure the global economy now is with GDP and GNP, and that only measures profit. That only measures the profit we get from the exchange of goods and services. But what if there is also a measure for what the impacts are on the environment, the impacts on our families, our social structures? And that's what gross national happiness that the Bhutanese came up with, that is now they've put it into the UN development matrix now. They are now at the United Nations demanding that development also include these new measures, such as gross national happiness. So there's a small social movement, right, that's growing globally, and the Bhutanese went directly to the United Nations.
Now, one thing is measuring it. Another thing is assigning accountability and responsibility.
Right. And that's where the issue of regulations come in, the rules and regulations that govern the economy. And we've been living in an era, particularly in this country, particularly in the United States, of deregulation, and that regulation is a bad thing because it interferes with the so-called free market. And as you pointed out at the very beginning, there's no such thing as a free market. Every market is managed by its rules and its regulations.
Right. Now, with the, for example, I mean, sticking with the example of coal, if people who burn coal, whether they be coal producers or utilities, were responsible for the health effects of coal and the environmental effects of coal, I'm guessing that they'd go into the rooftop solar business real quick.
Real quick. Real quick. And PNM is not going into it real quick. It's being dragged into it, very honestly. And that's one of the reasons I think people are so angry about this, because there's a real opportunity, particularly here, where we have so much sunshine, to get really serious about renewables and replacing coal-fired plants with solar energy, wind, geothermal, and how we build our homes and how we build our buildings.
We're talking to Merle Lefkoff, who is founder and president of the Center for Emergent Diplomacy. We're talking about the Bretton Woods 3.0 conference. Now, what is the Center for Emergent Diplomacy?
The Center for Emergent Diplomacy applies complex adaptive systems, complexity science, to international negotiations. And people, that's it. And so, as you mentioned earlier, you said I was an international mediator. I often introduce myself now, Mary Charlotte, as a recovering international mediator, because I haven't seen worldwide peace break
out. You haven't been able to do it all by yourself?
I haven't been able to do it, but we certainly have been trying for over 30 years. This issue of what's happening in our global economic system also affects war and peace. And this is the reason why I got very interested in paying more attention to these issues of what is the connection between global diplomacy, which is what we're interested in, and the systems, the complex systems that define war and peace. What does that have to do with global climate change? What does that have to do with the global economy? And so pulling it all together is pretty obvious among people who have thought about this, which is how much money we spend on war globally, which was $1.8 trillion in the last figure I saw, which was from 2012. $1.8 trillion. And in the United States, war is increasingly about civilian contractors. Billions and billions of dollars that could be going to our school systems, that could be going to more happiness for our people. So
It's not like we're winning these quote unquote whatever that even means, winning these conflicts.
That's right. In fact, for those people who know Basevich's work, and you do, I know, he has a new book out about why. I think the title of the book is something like, "Why are we the best army in the world and we keep losing?" Right? And he has a lot of reasons for that. But we do. We're in an endless war now, and we're in an endless war economy. I'm asked now by people who are struggling to try to understand what we're trying to do with the Bretton Woods Conference and how very different it is from any other conference that will be happening in 2016 or any other year, probably. They've asked me, Merle, your center is all about transforming the way diplomacy and negotiations is done. What does this have to do with the global economy and Bretton Woods? And so this is one of the things that I try to explain, that we are in an endless war economy globally now, and that we in the U.S. are promoting this as part of who we are, and that this is something else that needs to be explored.
And we're getting to the point, and it's also a very interesting point in a sort of horrible way, where, yesterday, as you pointed out, on the front of the Albuquerque Journal was a study that concluded that 51% of American students live in poverty. More than half of students in this country are living in poverty, which is a function of the world economy.
Yes, it is. That's exactly right. And this is just an indication, once again, of the situation for children all over the world, not just here. But let's just talk about New Mexico for a minute, right? 51% of the national population of children who are in public, now this is children in public schools, of course, public schools come under the poverty line. And they measured that, by the way, by looking at the ability to apply for free school luncheons, which right. I thought was pretty interesting, because poverty is about hungry children. And, there was a statistic not long ago about New Mexico that 1 out of 4 children in New Mexico go to bed hungry at night. It's just unacceptable in one of the richest countries in the world. Unacceptable.
So where's the money that would be feeding children and going into people's pockets? People are living on ridiculous wages at this point. Even people in quote-unquote middle-class jobs are earning less and less and less every year if you account for the decline in the buying power of each dollar that they earn. Where is that money? It's not that it doesn't exist.
No, money actually exists, and it is increasingly in the hands of fewer and fewer people. It's the issue of the inequality that has happened in this global financial system, the issue of the widening gap between the rich and the poor that is creating a new opportunity, I think, and a new realization that something on a mass global scale has got to change. And in order for that to happen, I happen to believe that is not going to happen because of public policy and our politicians. They have to be pushed into changing those policies, changing those structures, changing the way we do business.
So one of the problems that has been talked about a great deal and a little bit on this show as well is the question of money in politics. So what you have is the people who are essentially captains of the global economy putting the most money into political campaigns in the U.S. This is part of the conversation going on in Bretton Woods.
Absolutely is. It is. Money out of politics is very, very important. Because it isn't enough, as I said, just to be against something. You have to also promote the opportunity, for example, for us to have the opportunity to elect politicians who are not bought and sold. And the only way they can get elected is with vast amounts of money.
Now, we know this. Any ideas on how to change it?
Well, I think there are a lot of people in, you know, we don't call them nonprofits. We call them social profit organizations. We like that term better. In social profit organizations, especially in this country, that are looking at that very carefully and are promoting all kinds of social change, going online to raise money so that politicians can have public money in order to run for public office, for example. The Money Out of Politics movement, I think that's a small social movement, is part of this answer. It's not the only answer. There have to be many answers, but it's a big one, particularly in the United States.
We're talking to Merle Lefkoff about Bretton Woods 3.0. Now, this is a conference slated to take place in 2016, that's next year. What does it look like? Where is it? Who's coming? What's it all actually about specifically?
We really wanted to do, I should preface this by saying we really wanted to do this at Bretton Woods, just for old time's sake,
yeah,
for historical sake. But as I mentioned earlier, Bretton Woods is now owned by a huge multinational corporation where rooms are probably start about $450, $500 a night now.
Ah.
They weren't smart enough to understand that this might have been a good marketing thing for them. So we got nowhere with Bretton Woods,
okay,
because we did try to negotiate with them first. And then it hit us. You know what? Santa Fe is a perfect place for a conference like this. People all over the world love to come to Santa Fe. And so we decided we would do the conference here. So the way we're going to, we see our delegates, doing something about the history of the original Bretton Woods. They had 730 delegates at Bretton Woods, so we would like to invite 730 delegates to Bretton Woods 3.0 in Santa Fe.
Now, in 1944, who were these people? I mean, you said they were a group of white guys, but where did they come from?
They were diplomats, mostly. They were academicians, academics, diplomats, and politicians.
Not bankers and industrialists?
Well, there were some of them there, but truly, they were mostly diplomats and mostly economists, a lot of economists there, academics. That's really what the mix was.
Okay.
Was. We want to have a very interesting mix that never gets to meet each other at conferences. We'd like to invite the best grassroots leaders in the world. We're not going to nominate who those people are. We will be in touch, and we already are with many of them.
How do you identify them?
With organizations. We've identified them through our own work, because we do work globally. We've identified it through people we know who work with large social profit organizations and foundations who give grants to people at very local levels who have managed to start social movements. Those are the people we're going to ask organizations to nominate their best people. And we hope they're going to be young. We hope there is going to be a predominance of women and people of color, because that's what's missing usually at these big conferences.
And are you inviting people from every country in the world, kind of thing?
Well, no. We really won't have a criteria. Depending on where the best stuff is happening is where these people are going to come from. We want them to sit down, not just with each other, And they don't have a chance to meet, usually except online, because they can't afford to go to conferences. They can't afford to meet. We want them to sit down with, as I said earlier, some of the best thought leaders all over the world now. People like Thomas Piketty in France, who became, as we know, a rock star economist overnight here. Naomi Klein's new book. People like Naomi Klein, Thomas Piketty. People who are doing some of the best work everywhere in the world on thinking about the transformation of the present economy, what a new global economy would look like. George Soros. Oh, I'd love to have George Soros at this conference. He has started a whole institute on the new economy. And he's an industrialist. He's a billionaire. So we want a very uncommon mix. Now, George Soros, if he comes, will not be making a speech. He will be sitting in a working group with, who knows, grassroots activists from somewhere in Latin America or Africa.
So you've got, let's say, 730 people there, few or no speeches, lots of working groups. Then how does everybody get to know what happened in everybody else's group?
Mary Charlotte, I've been a professional facilitator for 32 years. And I'm part of a network of, I think, some of the best facilitators in the world. And there are all kinds of structures that we've been toying with and playing with over decades about how it isn't a question of reaching consensus. It's a question of getting into a dialogue where suddenly, scenarios are coming up that nobody has ever thought of before, so that there's an entrepreneurial spirit about new solutions and new thoughts. We want new solutions, and we want them to blend in such a way that people can walk away with whole new strategies for a global movement.
So you have an Indiegogo campaign. You are right now raising money for this conference.
Yes,
how
we
do
are.
People find that online?
Well, they go to our website would be the best way to find it online, and we'd love for them to go to the website anyway, because we have a lot of information about Bretton Woods.
And that is, the Center for Emergent Diplomacy website is emergentdiplomacy.org.
Yes, that's right. And there's a button on there to go to the Indiegogo campaign. And I have to tell you that we went into the Indiegogo campaign kind of blind, we should have understood this, that what it takes to raise money, and we're only asking for $55,000, which will what it will cost for a preliminary meeting to plan Bretton Woods and make sure it's, I can bring all those facilitators in and some
right.
of those key activists, right? $55,000 for just a preliminary meeting, that it takes thousands of people in your network and your lists to make that happen with small donations of $10 and $25 and $50. We don't have thousands of people on our list. We have hundreds of people in our list. So it's really important, not just for people to contribute some money, but also to put it on Facebook and send it out to there. And that's how you build a network. So I'm excited about this. We're off to a slow start, but we've got 40 days left.
Excellent.
Yeah. So that because we're also building a network at the same time, which will be so useful for Bretton Woods.
So we look forward to hearing more about it as the months go by and as it draws closer. Do you have a date set yet?
We've checked with the city, because we want the whole city involved in this. If we're going to bring, you know, almost 1,000 people in for this conference, then the whole city will want to get involved. And people, I hope, will want to house many of our delegates so they can get to know them, you know. And So we've set the date of May 2016, because the conference center, our conference center is available, and then the different venues are available. We've got a budget. We've talked to a lot of people in the city of Santa Fe already to make sure it could accommodate a conference this large.
Well, we look forward to hearing more about it and keeping up with you as the time goes by. Very, very interesting work. Merle Lefkoff, international mediator, founder and president of the Center for Emergent Diplomacy, former guest scientist at the Center for Nonlinear Studies at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.